B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
This is a heavy podcast. If you're into heavy music, man, this is a good one for you. With Dave Lombardo and Todd Evans today. First, we'll get into Dave. Of course, he was in Slayer. He's been in a billion other bands. It's like, I had to ask him, it's like, do bands know what they're getting when they ask you to play with their band?
They know. They're getting a downbeat. They're getting energy. They're getting fire. And, hopefully all the elements that are necessary to complete a band.
Will he go see the final Slayer show? We ask him about that. We talk about playing the Misfits, Spinal Tap and Spinal Tap moments, as well as bands that may have asked him to play that for whatever reason he couldn't join them.
Some of those bands just came to me at the wrong time, and it doesn't mean that I'm not saying no. Completely.
We talk about the brand new documentary he had a chance to score about a Cuban band named Zeus. I asked him about working with Mike Patton. We talk about the late Ginger Baker, Vinnie Paul, and Dimebag Darrell, as well as a thought or two about the legendary Clash of the Titans tour when a fairly unknown band named Alice in Chains opened up.
And then another time, I remember Lane Staley and Jerry coming into the dressing room. They were showing Hanneman some of their new music.
Up next, it's Todd Evans. He's in a band right now called Mobile Death Camp, but you might know him best from his time in Gwar when he was Beefcake the Mighty. How did he get that gig?
And then while we were on that tour, Brocky was just like, look, I'm bringing you into the band. I want you to be Beefcake.
Oh, the stories Todd's going to tell. And a lot have to do with Brocky.
I'd go to his house and just be him and I sitting there watching football and just talking like people. And then one more person would come in, and then all of a sudden it's a stage.
Wait until you hear the story about these six words.
And then he just projectile vomits.
Oh, man, that's a good one. It's drumming legend Dave Lombardo and Todd Evans from Mobile Death Camp and Gwar today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Hey, thanks so much for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. A little bit of housekeeping before we start up with Dave and Todd. If you like this podcast, give it a 5-star rating, write a review, share with your friends, of course, and leave me a voicemail if you'd like at 248-586-2988, as I like to get your guys' feedback as far as the podcast is concerned. Hey, coming up second, like I said in the intro, it's Todd Evans, guitarist and singer for Mobile Death Camp. He spent, I want to say, like 8 years or something in Gwar, and well, I'll talk about this more with the interview, but I just met him back in the spring, and I thought, man, this guy, he's so charismatic. He's such a nice guy. He's gigantic, too. And we just hit it off right away, and I told him then, I'm like, dude, I got to get you on the podcast. It's been a long time coming, but today is the day. And I thought, you know what, since I'm talking to Dave Lombardo, of course, from his time in Slayer, and I mean, just a numerous other bands, I thought this would be a perfect marriage of just two guys who have played in some pretty heavy-duty bands. We'll start out with Dave Lombardo. He's got this documentary he scored. I'm going to try this out. My Spanish isn't very good. Los Ultimos Fricus. I'm not sure if I butchered that or not, but he scores this about this band from Cuba named Zeus. It's a metal band that's been around as long as he has, and he talks a little bit about more about the freedoms he shares here in the United States as opposed to what they've had to go through in their whole life. As usual with some of these interviews, I try to text some of my friends who know these guys, and I texted David Ellison. I'm like, hey, tell me something about Dave. He's like, oh, ask him about Grip Incorporated. I'm like, all right, Grip Inc. And I'm like, okay, cool. I did ask him about that. We got into a little bit about that conversation right there. My friend Bob Tyrell is like this a world famous tattoo artist. He's tattooed Kerry King and Gary Holt and all these guys in Slayer. So I'm like, tell me something about Dave. Oh, I love Dave. Tell him I said hello. That doesn't help me much. And Frank Bello from Anthrax, another guy, texted. I'm like, hey, dude, give me something for Dave. He says, oh, I love Dave. We should tour together. I just want to hang out with the guy. And that's how we start the conversation today with Dave Lombardo, drumming legend on Talkin' Rock.
Mm.
That'd be great. Who knows?
Yeah.
That can happen.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're on like about 800 tours, which we'll get into here coming up in just a few minutes. But so tell us about this.
It seems like Frankie only tours with my former bandmate. You know, they only do tours with them.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's talk about this documentary that you scored. Now, you've done this kind of thing before, correct?
Yes. I mean, I've just been, used like in certain sections of certain films. Like I helped a little bit on Insidious 3. Joseph Bashar, the composer, had me come in and, you know, create some drum textures and tones and movements, you know, and musical movements through some of the film's more darker moments. And I worked with Tyler Bates, who's a dear friend of mine, on several, Dawn of the Dead back in 2004. You know, I worked a little bit on Californication season 7 with Tyler. We were in the studio at Capitol Records. It was amazing. We watching, you know, parts of the movie. Or parts of the program, the TV show, HBO, whatever it was, and, you know, playing along to the film. And, you know, for example, they told me, okay, the song needs to end right when he closes the door. Mm. So I'm watching, and then I have to do a drum roll leading up to him closing the door, and then boom, end the song. So it's a lot of fun, man. I love doing this, and the fact that I can do it in the privacy of my own home and sit and be creative and absorb whatever it is the film is emanating. It's awesome.
Now, I was going to say, none of us are getting any younger. So do you see a time in the future when this is what you do as opposed to going on tour with rock bands?
No.
No.
Come on, man. I love playing drums and being on stage and, you know, going on tour, visiting all these fine cities and just it's part of my life. It's going to be difficult to slow me down, man. Here I am, 54, and my wife is like, wow, you are the Energizer Bunny. You're just like always going. It's like, well, hey, you know, it's just my nature. I realized, you know, several years ago, I put myself in a different perspective. You know, instead of I'm always the hyper one. Oh God, you're so hyper. You're so full of energy. It's like, no, you are all slow. That's the problem. You know, I'm just at a different tape speed than you are. You know, I'm running at 45. You guys are at 33 and a third.
So you score this movie about this band. Now, I would imagine out of all the things that you've scored, this is probably closest to your heart, right?
Yes, it is, because obviously most people know I was born in Havana, Cuba, and my parents in the middle of the revolution that was going on there at that time decided to, you know, immigrate to the United States. And so I found that this documentary really hit home. It felt very personal. Because what these guys endured, you know, while I was in the States, you know, playing, you know, starting Slayer and playing in that band and doing shows. And, you know, I had two bands before I even joined Slayer. And so as a child, as a kid, I was here, you know, flourishing.
Mm.
And to know that these guys had the same passion, had the same drive that I had, and they were being oppressed. You know, the singer was jailed for 6 years, you know, for playing metal music.
Wow.
And so it just goes to show what these guys have gone through for the love and for the love of music and what at times we all take for granted and take for granted some of the freedoms that we have. So, you know, it really hit home, and it felt very natural for me to dive into this project wholeheartedly and with the same passion that, you know, of, you know, like when I play on stage and with that same love. So it was a treat.
Yeah.
I was really honored to be a part of it.
Checking out some of the trailers and stuff, it reminded me kind of like the Anvil doc, or maybe even to some extent the Metallica documentary. Did you see any of that in this documentary?
actually know.
Okay.
I stay away from a lot of, you know, let's say I've never watched the Anvil documentary, and I'm really sorry. I apologize. Maybe I should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same with the you know, the Metallica documentary. You know, I hear so much from the underground, and it resonates, and I want to leave my perception of these bands, leave it alone. There's some things I just don't want to see.
Gotcha.
And I have a love, deep love and respect, not only for Metallica, but for Anvil and everything that they've gone through, that, you know, I have a respect for them, and, you know, I don't like it being tarnished or anything. And it's just, you know, it is what it is.
Now, I don't live in the same world. I mean, I've been in the music business for three decades, and so have you, but obviously we've both lived different worlds and different lifestyles. But it's like these were like kind of doors and gateways open into what they go through on a daily basis. And for somebody like me, I thought it was kind of interesting, but you live it, so maybe you don't need to see it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It might be interesting. Yes. Yeah. It's like, oh, man, yeah, I don't want to watch that. You know, it's like, you know, so it's kind of strange. But there are documentaries that I do watch. You know, there's, you know, of bands, you know, that existed, you know, so, you know, a time back, you know, whether it's Zeppelin or Cream or these documentaries of Jimi Hendrix or John Coltrane or Miles Davis, you know, female vocalists, R&B female vocalists from the 60s. I can't think of her name, but, you know, these are very fascinating stories of these artists, and those intrigue me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you saw Spinal Tap, so you don't really have to see any more, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Finally. You know what? This was years. Well, I don't know. It could have been 10 years ago. I was hanging with Gary Holt. Let me tell you, this is 10 years ago.
Mm.
And so this is kind of recent in my career. He says, oh, you know, Spinal Tap this, Spinal Tap that. He was commenting something about Spinal Tap. I said, Gary, I quite honestly haven't seen that movie from beginning to end. And he flipped out. What? You haven't seen that movie? What the fuck? Dave, where did I said? I said, whoa, wait. I've seen bits and pieces of the movie at times. Let's say I'm walking, you know, through the bus and somebody has it on in front of the bus or in the back of the bus, and I'll sit there and watch a little bit of it. And just sigh, you know. Oh, God. Yes. Okay. Drummer blows up. Yes. I'm fascinated by this. But it's a great story. And I recently saw Spinal Tap. So
nice. Yeah.
I'm a latecomer here. So
I think Frankie Benelli one time told me a story where he was watching on the bus laughing in hysterics. And Kevin DeBrow and David Coverdale were on the bus in horror watching it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt, you know. Well, I reckon I know how it's impossible sometimes to find the stage. Which way is the stage? You're about to go on stage in 2 minutes, and you're like, hey, which way do I go? Stage left or stage right? I don't care, man. I just want to get to the stage. And so, yeah, I can relate to a lot of that movie, although I have not blown up.
Yeah, so. Thankfully, yeah. So you just mentioned Gary. I know him like a tiny little bit, but of course, I mean, you know, listen, the fans, I post on my social media, I was going to be talking to you, and they have a ton of Slayer questions, of course. I mean, are you going to go to the last show? Do you have any interest in all that stuff or no?
No.
No.
Come on, man.
I'm just asking. No. I just got to ask.
Yeah, I know.
Well, this,
actually,
you know, like the,
I don't know.
It's like the world of reunions coming up next year and stuff. I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes or anything like that. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I think I have a show on that day.
Okay.
You know what? I'm playing Knotfest in Mexico City and then heading over to El Salvador and playing another festival. So, you know, I'm on stage.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you are in like a billion bands now, right?
Not a billion, a couple hundred.
What band are you playing with Knotfest?
Suicidal.
Okay. You had to think about that for a second. Okay. So I'm not that far off.
No. I did. And earlier I was doing another interview. It's like, wait, did I mention that I was in the Misfits as well?
Yeah.
You know, I had to think about it, you know, but, I'm losing my mind, but it's all good. You know, I have somebody taking care of me, you know, in regards to my schedule and pointing me in the right direction. So I'm good.
Yeah. And she's doing a great job. You know, I wanted to ask you about working with Mike Patton, because you've worked with him a lot in the past. What is it like working with Mike Patton? I got a Mike Patton story of my own, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he's one of the most kindest humans I've ever met. He's an amazing artist. He's a dear friend whom I love and respect. To work with him, it's an absolute pleasure to work with a guy. He's so creative and so musically inclined in various instruments, and you know, in his vocal range. My God, 7-octave range. The guy is a master at his art. So, you know, and this is the honest truth. I would say it if I met him once, twice, or like I've known him for, God, I don't know how many years, 20 some years, probably longer. So he's definitely a great human, and I'm very fortunate to know him and play in 2 bands with him. Or I've actually played in 3.
I was going to say,
maybe 4 or 5, because I've done improvisations and random improvisations, whether it's with a saxophone or a violin player or Bill Laswell, bass player, with John Zorn. We've done so much together that that I really cherish our friendship.
Now, you are in so many bands. So when a band is like your band, do you take a different approach as to like an established band, like a Suicidal or Misfits or anything like that?
No. You know, in Suicidal, you know, Mike Muir is the man. He's the boss. He's the one that, you know, says, hey, we're thinking about playing this show or that show. And he always comes to me and, you know, and asks the band, hey, are you guys available? You know, and whether we are or we're not, we always chime in and, you know, we let them know. In Dead Cross, that, yes, I was the one that had part in starting that band. One band crumbled. And as that band was crumbling, I contacted the producer that was going to record the band that was crumbling. And, you know, he said, hey, Dave, don't worry about it. And he said, why don't you come over tomorrow? I have this session I'd like for you to dabble and, you know, play some drums on. And I show up at his recording studio, and there's the bass player and the guitar player currently in Dead Cross. And, you know, so... Yeah, it's kind of my band, but I allow everyone to chime in and, you know, and give their opinion. You know, I don't run a dictatorship or anything like that. I'm like so chill. You know, I like to hear everyone's opinion. And
yeah, and I saw you with Suicidal a couple years ago on that Megadeth tour, which came through Detroit here. And it's like, I guess when a band like Suicidal is looking for a drummer and they look to you, they know what they're getting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They know they're getting a downbeat. They're getting energy. They're getting fire. And, hopefully all the elements that are necessary to complete a band. And to make sure that the music is delivered in the most respectful and honest way, you know, because that's the last thing I want to do is overplay or, you know, throw my weight around in a way that, you know, it's not fun to be around. You know, I always want to be a team player. So it's definitely it's not a challenge to fit in and be the chameleon in the band that changes his color as he's going from one band to another.
Now, speaking of that, what is like the strangest collaboration you've been in? Because you've been in so many different projects.
I think to me that's not nothing is strange
no.
to me.
okay.
It kind of a saxophonist, a very renowned saxophonist, composer, New York City avant-garde kingpin, performing with me on a little four-piece drum kit at the Louvre Museum in Paris, France.
Wow.
under that glass pyramid. Mm. Right under that glass pyramid, I set up a little drum set, and him and I just went off. I think that's the most bizarre, but not unreachable, or it's nothing that's not uncomprehensible. It's just something that was very different for me. But I've done that before. I've played at LACMA, at the Los Angeles Museum of Art, Contemporary Museum of Art. I played in the artist Jackson Pollock, who is an avant-garde painter, and John Zorn and I performed in that room, inspired by these paintings.
Wow!
To perform, and so that was unique as well. So.
Now, you mentioned you mentioned Cream a couple minutes ago, and I've talked to a couple guys, Vinny Appice, one of them, and Joe Bonamassa, another one, in the last like few weeks here, and they both had like, you know, their thoughts that they've both met and worked with Ginger Baker. Have you ever had a chance to run across him?
I don't know if I would have wanted to, you know, because
you're not the only one.
The birth of heavy metal should have been aborted.
Right.
So if I told him, he would have probably strangled me or hit me in the face with his cane. Now that's a documentary I enjoyed, you know. Beware of Mr. Baker was amazing. You know, he said, you know, the birth of heavy metal should have been aborted.
Right.
And for me to go up to him and say, you know, Ginger, my name is Dave Lombardo. I am the drummer in a metal band called, I was in a metal band called Slayer, and you inspired us. You know, what the fuck? He would have fucking clobbered me, man.
Hey, speaking of...
It would have been a compliment, you know, to be clobbered by Ginger Baker. Just think, you know? Like, hey, see this shiner right here? Fucking Ginger did that, man.
That would be killer. So, speaking of, like, somebody that inspired you, who would be someone that people might be surprised that inspired you?
I think the biggest inspiration to me came from bands, Latin bands, Cuban Latin jazz bands, you know, salsa bands. When I was a kid, my parents used to go to this Cuban club, and we used to watch, and my parents would be dancing, and they thought I was like hanging out with a bunch of kids just running around, you know, just playing. But my mom couldn't find me, and I was backstage sitting on a piano stool just watching the drummer.
Mm.
So, you know, watching them play with this energy and this passion, I think fueled my personal, you know, drive to play drums and you know, be creative and be a part of a band. I mean, I saw members of those bands. I'll never forget. You know, they had their little flask backstage. They do a little drink, you know, and I saw them, you know, interact with each other. And, you know, they didn't know who I was. I was just a fly on a wall, you know, watching this. And I think, you know, then later, of course, metal and rock, or should I say rock. And actually, we're going to go a step further. R&B, funk, rock, and then metal. because my brothers, my older brothers were into, you know, different styles of music. It wasn't just rock. They were into, my oldest brother was into Tina Turner, was into War, was into more of the R&B style. And my second oldest brother, he was more into Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, Cream, and those, you know, those different, you know, styles of bands at that time. So I had a combination of influences.
So a couple more things here for you, and we'll cut you loose. Vinnie Paul was a friend of mine. I wonder if you have any stories about him. And, of course, Dimebag, we're coming up on the 15th anniversary of his death in just a couple of weeks. What are your thoughts about those two guys?
Wow, it's unfortunate and sad that they've, you know, passed on. But, you know, the wonderful thing about music, and I think religions have it all wrong. You know, they say to have eternal life, you need to follow this religion or follow this dude or accept this or accept that. I think to have eternal life, you need to be a musician. Then your music will live forever, and your spirit and your drumming and whatever it is that you gave musical birth to will withstand the test of time. And so I feel that, you know, we're very lucky to have those two brothers, you know, walk this earth and create this music that will, you know, keep them alive.
Now, just talking to you about this, I know Roy Mayorga is now, you know, with Hell Yeah and stuff like that. Has there been any bands that have come and asked you to join that you just couldn't join for whatever reason, whether scheduling or just didn't want to do it or anything?
Yes. But I would not like to, you know,
gotcha,
comment on those bands or say who they are. But yes, I've had to turn projects down and bands down. But some of those bands just came to me at the wrong time. And it doesn't mean that I'm not saying no, you know, completely, you know, declining them. It's just at the time, it's just not the right time. So there's a possibility, and there are projects in the future that you will hear about that I cannot mention, you know, at the moment, that I'm currently working on.
Really? Okay.
There's always something up my sleeve.
I'm sure there is, because you're going at 45 all the time. Hey, that's right. Hey, one of my buddies is a drummer, and this is a drumming question. So he said, did you ever want to tune your drums lower playing with Slayer? And what was it such a part of the, or was it such a part of the sound you didn't want to change it?
The tuning in Slayer, the drum tuning in Slayer, is my natural tune. Whatever I felt, what I feel is, it's like, okay, if this series of toms do not follow in the register that I feel comfortable in, then I'll either bring it up or bring it down. I've been in situations where a drum tech will tune my drums, and I'll go through them, and I'll say, okay, Tom 4 is out of pitch. We need to bring that up a little bit. Or they're all low. And I say, hey, the tuning is all correct, but let's bring them up, you know, in pitch or the register. Let's bring it up an octave. So they pop a little bit more. But I've never said, oh, let me bring them lower. You know, I think, you know, bringing a pitch on a drum kit, you know, bringing the drums and the toms at a lower pitch, I think would resonate better on songs that are a lot slower, that are a lot more, you know, in a different style. You know, I think you're going to need to play when you play fast music, you should bring the pitch up, so that way the response of your drumstick is a lot quicker, and you can get around the drum set, you know, for that style of music.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm not a drummer, but hey, final thing, Clash of the Titans, you were on that tour, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I that was one of the first like major shows I think I did a stager from in Buffalo in Darien, New York, and I got on stage I think after Alice in Chains or something. But tell me your memories about that tour. I mean, I've talked to all the guys from from the Anthrax guys and Dave Ellefson and all that about that tour. I mean, that was that your guys' first big like thrash major tour?
No, I believe we were on a major tour prior to that.
No, I'm talking about like where all the bands are all like thrash bands from that, from that era.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yes. That was the first tour that focused on this genre. Although Alice in Chains wasn't, part of that genre, they were being introduced as a new genre. And what I remember, actually, I was talking to Jerry Cantrell the other day, and I had, I told him, I remember, pulling up at some of these outdoor festivals, these sheds, as you call them, these amphitheaters. And some of these amphitheaters, especially one in particular in the Midwest somewhere, there was a lake and the tour bus pulled up and there's Jerry and one of the other guys, I forget, and they were fishing. He had brought his fishing pole, and any chance, any day off he had, he just relaxed and fished, that was awesome. I'm sure it was a catch and release kind of situation, because I don't know where he would have, put the fish or cooked it,
Right.
And then another time I remember Lane Staley and Jerry coming into the dressing room at one of our shows. And, they were showing Hanneman some of their new music.
Really? That would become Dirt, I would assume, right? That would become Dirt, which is like a legendary record.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And because Jeff loved them. Jeff thought they were an amazing band. And he really liked Jerry's style and his playing and the melodies and the harmonies.
Yeah.
That's one thing beautiful about Alice in Chains, or should I say Jerry's vocals or style of writing, is the harmonies.
Yeah, he told me once that's where Alice in Chains earned their bones. I never forgot that comment.
They earned their bones?
Yeah, on that tour, because they were out there with, you guys, Megadeth and Anthrax, and no one really knew who they were. And they took a lot of heat up there on stage, playing their songs and stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that
they
was...
They did, and it took a lot of balls, because, Slayer fans, they showed no mercy.
Right. I can imagine. Well, Dave, good luck on this documentary and the 876 other things you have to do. And
877.
You're playing with the Misfits coming up here, right? At the beginning of the year or something, right? Man.
Yeah. Where are you located?
We're in Detroit.
You're in Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to be too far. I'll be in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's. I don't know if I'll be able to make that gig out there, but next time you come through Detroit, I'll have to hook up with Tyrell and stuff and come and say hi to you.
Absolutely, man. You're more than welcome.
All right, Dave. Good luck with everything. Have a great holiday season, and we'll see you next year probably, okay?
All right, man. Take care. Thanks.
Never had a chance to interview Dave before, but people that I know him or have met him say what a nice guy he is. And there you go. There's proof of that. Dave Lombardo today on the Talkin' Rockwood Meltdown podcast. Go out and check out that documentary, Los Ultimos Fricus. Like I said, I'm sure I'm completely butchering that title, but that's as close as I could get to that. Like I said in the intro, I met Todd Evans back in the spring. We'll talk about that coming up here in a bit at a Gary Holt guitar signing and clinic and different things. And I just liked the guy. As soon as I met him, someone said, hey, that's Todd. He used to be in Guar. Now he's in Mobile Death Camp. And we started talking. And first of all, he's a big Red Wings fan, which we'll talk about as well. And I'm a huge hockey fan, too. But Todd just seems like such a good guy. And some of these stories and some of the events that he recalls are so great. This is probably not going to be the first time you're going to hear him on this podcast. It's Todd Evans today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. Hope you guys enjoy this.
Meltdown, my dude. Things are great, man. How's things with you?
I'll tell you what, the Wings winning a few games here and there. You're a big hockey fan, right?
Oh, fucking, I love hockey, man. Love it. I watched a game last night. It was, I don't want to say it was heartbreaking, but, we still got a point out of the deal, but yeah, it's been nice to see him put four in a row.
Right, exactly. No question about it. So anyway, so I want to tell everybody, first of all, so I met you back in the spring, and you were there was a Gary Holt signing here. Of course, Gary Holt from Slayer and Exodus. And you showed up, and I don't know, I just felt like right away, like, I got to talk to this guy on my podcast because, you know, you got all this stuff that's going on in your life between your band, and of course you were in Gwar and stuff, and we'll get to that here in just a couple minutes. But how do you know Gary?
I met Gary, way back before he was doing Slayer. There was a tour manager that was tour managed us back in 2002. And then he was tour managing Exodus in like 2004
okay.
or 2003. And then, I was like, hey, I'm going to go to the show, you know, and he got, you know, just chocolate in your peanut butter and peanut butter in my chocolate. And I was like, I know this dude, I know that dude. He's like, well, I'm working with Exodus. I was like, I'm there.
Yeah. So,
and then he introduced me and we just hit it off. Like, they're super cool guys.
No, that's great. Yeah, Gary's he's awesome. So you showed up for that thing, and people may or may not know, but paint a little picture here. How big are you?
7'8". I'm 6'5", and I go about 365.
All right, so you're a little bit bigger than me.
A little bit, yeah. just a touch.
Yeah, just a little bit, with me and my 5'6" stature. But anyway, so you told me the funniest story. Can we relay the Harpo story you told me that time I met you, or no?
We can, yeah. My mind's kind of cloudy on
okay.
the story, though.
Well, you told me, well, first of all, you know, Harpo's is a legendary concert venue, especially for, like, metal bands and stuff throughout,
absolutely.
You know, throughout the country, right?
Sure.
And it's not in the greatest of neighborhoods, and there has been some bad stuff that's happened in the Harpo's neighborhoods.
No, yeah. For
and,
sure.
And so you said to me, you said, people always ask me, you know, about Harpo's when I go around the country. So anyways, you said that there was an incident that you guys were done with sound check or something. I'm assuming you were with Gwar, right? Is that right? And you walked over to get some food, and you said there was a car that had its doors open.
Yeah. I wasn't on stage. I wasn't in the show at that time. It was me and a friend of mine went to see Morbid Angel.
Okay.
Or Motorhead and Morbid Angel. It was a while ago. We were all high up, you know, and it's Harpo's. We're having a blast and fucking, because, you know, I've been at Harpo's so many times. It's my home club, you know?
Right.
So we're walking across the street. We're parked across the street next to that grocery store, whatever that is, and just to the left of it. So we're walking. Yeah, we're walking through the parking lot, and there's nobody in the parking lot, and there's a car backed halfway out of its space, and it's running, and the doors are open. And we're just walking up there like, oh, shit. You know, the closer you get, the more sketched out it gets. Am I allowed to cuss?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so the closer you get to the car, the more sketched out we get because, you know, again, it's Harpo's, it's the area, it's Detroit. And we get close, and this, you know, like I said, so I'm 6'5", like 360. I wasn't quite 360 at the time, but I was 6'5". So this figure steps out and just, like, blocks out the fucking... would have blocked out the sun. He's wearing this big, long, black leather trench and in a big, just a big fucking huge man. And he says, is that your motherfucking car? And we're just like, no. And then he goes, then I suggest you get the fuck on out of here. And we're just like, oh, shit. Fucking ain't right. We started fucking walking about double step, got in a dude's car and, you know, and we're just like, oh shit, like handed the joint back and forth. Oh fuck.
Yes.
I'm never coming back here again. Yeah, me neither. You know, and then whatever, we were there probably.
Yeah, you know, somebody's night didn't end very well, I would assume.
Oh,
so.
Oh man, I can't even imagine. I don't even want to speculate what the fuck that was about,
Jeez.
Man. That was crazy.
Hey, so let's go back to the beginning here. So so how did you get the gig in Gwar as Beefcake the Mighty? And of course, you're one of, I think, four or five throughout history. But how did you get that gig, and what year was that?
It's one of several Mighties.
Yeah.
I got hired in 2002. Corey Smoot got hired the same day I did.
Right.
And oddly enough, he's originally from the Toledo area as well. So, but I was in a band down here near Toledo, well, based out of Toledo, called Porn Flakes. And yeah, we used to do like some, you know, I'm doing air quotes, theatrical-ish shit. And we kind of did different things. And so it was our goal. You know, GWAR was like one of our favorite bands. And we totally bit on a lot of their fucking stuff. So we'd always try to get the gig with them if they played close, you know, or played, you know. So we ended up doing shows with them around the region, around, you know, Cleveland, Detroit, Toledo, Cincinnati, Fort Wayne-ish. So then one time we were playing in Richmond after a show. We were down somewhere, and they were out at the show hanging out, too. And they're just like, yeah, man, we know we're going to need some. We're thinking about hiring. We need a new bass player. And they're like, we know you play guitar, but we'd like you to play bass. Cause I was just like, yeah, you know, I might do that. And then that fell through. That was in like 98. And then Brocky had a side band called the Dave Brocky Experience. And then I was in a band after that called Lazy American Workers, a punk band. And Dave Brocky's band took us out on a national tour. And then while we were on that tour, Brocky was just like, look, I'm bringing you into the band. I want you to be Beefcake. I was just like, yeah, I'll fucking totally do it. That would be great. And that was basically it, you know. And it was a wonderful love-hate affair for 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008. And then I jumped out.
Why was it a love-hate? What do you mean?
I mean, it was just the craziest shit. It was everything you can imagine. You know, if you're sitting in the crowd watching a GWAR show, you're like, this is the wildest, funniest shit ever, you know? But if you're on the other side of the stage, you're like, oh my God, he did that again. This guy's doing that. Oh, that guy, this guy, you know, it was difficult at times. There was a couple people that tried to really make it rough for everyone, you know, I was just like, look, you guys, you're not carrying bricks. You're not waking up at 5 a.m. to carry bricks all day in the sun. You know, you're on stage playing music for like an hour and a half every day. Like, you got it good. We got it really good here. We got it licked.
Well, what do you mean people were, there were people like people in the band or management or gatekeepers or what was it?
Guy, there was a guy in the band. Brocky was a difficult entity.
Really?
He was very difficult. He was charismatic as fuck. He'd be the nicest dude. And then all in one breath, you'd just like, I'm going to fucking kick that guy right in the eye. Fuck that dude. You know, like,
really?
He was wild, man. He was the wildest dude I've ever met in my life. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I love the dude. You know, we're brothers in arms, and I'm fucking proud to have served, you know. And it's just like, you know, they say, like, see that Doors movie where Jim Morrison, he's just difficult.
Right.
You know? But at the same time, and they interview the drummer, Densmore, he goes, yeah, I guess, you know, when it's all said and done, I was in a band with Jim Morrison. You know, that's how I am with Brocky, you know. I go to his house and just be him and I sitting there watching football and just talking like people. And then one more person would come in, and then all of a sudden it's a stage.
Oh, really?
You know, you know, like, it's just like, boom. And he didn't have an off switch. He was just on all the time. Just crazy as fuck. Like,
wow.
Nice dude. Just the wildest dude. Like, and that's why now GWAR is kind of, you know, GWAR was Dave's neurosis, you know, and it kind of lacks without him, you know, and I'm glad those guys are still going, and I fucking, you know, more power to them, man. And I know that's their livelihood and it's their thing. And, you know, they're doing, you know, they're still fucking smashing places, man. But, you know, everybody misses Dave, I guess.
Yeah, and
Corey. I don't mean to sell Corey short, you know, but he wasn't the creator of it all. But
right. Yeah. You know, it's that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, just touring and playing with GWAR. I mean, it seems from the outside looking in like it was just a wild existence, was it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It was a shit ton of work, too. You know, we don't have any roadies. So the guys that are in the band that are like the, you know, that do the slaves that hop around on stage and get beat and carry out all the different props and jump into monster costumes, you know, they're moving shit. We're moving shit. You know, we're all like, it's the crew. And there's like, you know, sometimes 14, 15 guys sleeping on a bus that sleeps 12, you know, has 12 beds. So, you know, it's genuinely like a slave ship, we called it, you know. We'd be down there just all jammed in, One time we're going, we're on the Sounds of the Underground tour, and Chimera was on that tour. So we got 15 guys on our bus already, and their bus breaks down, and they call us at like fucking, I don't know, three in the morning, two in the morning. We're like, yeah, we'll come and get you. So we stop on the side of the road, pick up them. There's 9 people on their bus. And they get on the bus with us. Now there's 14, you know, that's easy math. 14 plus 9 is like 80. I don't know. It seemed like it, man. There's people like laying down. They were laying down fucking head to toe in the aisle all the way down the fucking bus.
Oh, jeez.
So yeah, I get out and piss, you know, because I'm an old guy, so I got to get out and piss. And I get down and try not to step on anybody's head. You know, I can't see shit, and it's just like, oh, it was crazy.
I can't even imagine how you could fit into a bunk, to be quite honest with you. I mean, very big.
No, I called it my drawer.
Yeah, really?
I got to get in my drawer. You know, if you take your elbow and sit it on the table and put your arm straight up, and where your fingers, and you keep your fingers extended straight up, from the elbow to the top of my fingers was exactly how tall it was from the pad to the ceiling inside the bunk.
Oh,
and it was only about 8 inches wider than me.
Right.
And only about just like a few inches longer than me.
Man.
So it was, you know, it was very coffin-esque.
No doubt. Do you remember your first gig with Gwar?
Oh, yeah. That was the day after my birthday in 2002.
Wow.
It was, it was at the House of Blues in South Carolina, not Charleston, Myrtle Beach. Yeah. It was fucking awesome as shit. I was, you know, bundle of nerves, bundle of energy, bundle of excitement. And it was Corey's first show, too. So, you know, we're like a couple of fucking fawns together, kind of like walking around. The day of the show, walking around, walk over here together, walk over there, like, hey, fuck it. You know, and those guys totally made it as easy as they could for us by just like haranguing us and throwing shit at us and yelling at us the whole time, you know.
Now, could you
came down to the show and it was nice.
Could you play your instrument like, you know, the way you wanted to with all the get up on and everything that's going on the stage? Or was it that was just part of the deal?
Yeah. Yeah, it was tough to get used to at first. For me, I didn't play bass at first, you know, so
right.
Playing bass. So that was weird. The next longer, I got to reach further, you know, and after I played bass for about 3 weeks, I was like, man, I can crush a bowling ball with my hand now, you know, just like, and then they're like, okay, maybe you start wearing part of the costume to get used to that. So, you know, when you're playing guitar, your guitar is like lays right on your belly. You can feel it. You know, on your belly, and you can feel it on your hip. You can feel it moving around. So on my costume was like a fiberglass big chest plate that went down to my waist, and it stuck out a little bit. So now the bass is like 6 inches out in front of me on this thing. I can't feel it at all. It's just kind of like out there. So now both my arms are out further, and it's just changed everything, you know, and I'm like, oh, fuck, this is wild. And they're like, yeah, try it with the helmet on. And then I put that helmet on, and I was just like, oh, my gosh. I didn't say anything to those guys. I was like, this isn't going to work. I'm never going to be able to do this. I don't know how the fuck that guy does this. This is crazy. And then, you know, more and more, and I got kind of used to it. And then it was like, I played football, you know, which isn't a big surprise back
right,
in the day.
Right.
And so I wasn't, you know, it wasn't totally new to have a helmet on my head. And then after a while, it was just, but this thing was, you know, as high as I could reach with my hand and stick my fingers over. That's how tall the spike was on the top of my head.
And you probably played some stages that maybe were a little bit lower, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We played some real shitholes where I had to stand squatted or like stand out far enough to like try to be in front of the overhang on the stage. Oh, man. Yeah, predicaments galore.
So you must have just a repertoire of Spinal Tap moments. I mean, you have to, right?
yeah. And it's, you know, it's like when you're talking to a comedian, like, hey, tell me a joke, and you go, people go, give me your best Dave Brocky story, and I'm like, fuck, you know. And then, but if you're just sitting around bullshitting, like we were standing around, you know, when Gary was doing that signing, it was just like, boom, story, story, story. You know, people, you know, you stand around with dudes that all have stories. and you're throwing stuff off, and one triggers another one, another guy, oh, shit, oh, this thing, oh, you know, but...
Yeah, so yeah. Where were you when you found out that David had passed?
We were on tour, actually. I was in South Carolina, which is kind of ironic that my first GWAR show was in South Carolina, and then I heard Dave left the building. I was also in South Carolina.
Now, you were in Mobile Death Camp at the time?
Yes.
And you were touring. Cause, so you were already out of GWAR for, like, what, 3 or 4 years, something like that?
Yep, 3 years.
Yeah.
Or no, Dave was out. He left in 13. So I was out in 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, so like 5 years
about
out.
About 5 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did that come as a surprise to you?
Dave passing?
Yeah.
Man, no. I mean, I don't speak of it, you know. I'm not speaking lightly of it either, you know. I don't mean like, fuck, you know, that
right.
You know,
right.
I fucking love that dude, you know. He did a fucking shit ton for me, and I'll always be fucking thankful for what he did. And I wasn't surprised. I mean, he was an alien, man. He just sometimes, you know, he's just drinking and just fucking partying and fucking doing this and doing that and fucking just, wow, man, how do you fucking do it? You know, how do you bounce back and like every day on tour? But you know, and they're not unique. Like a ton of bands, when the bus rolls up to a town on the rider, you know, they bring in fucking 8, 9 bottles of whiskey, booze, gin, wine, fucking 3 cases or 4 cases of beer. And you know, every day that comes onto the bus, on the different buses, man. You go, and I didn't, you know, I didn't drink and party. So me and one other guy, 15 or 14, didn't drink. So you know,
so
like,
what's
our budget for booze?
Yeah, were you kind of like the I don't know, for lack of a better term, like the adult in the room?
I mean. No. I was just sober in the room.
I got you.
Definitely not the adult. The you know one and God one thing one I guess one of the funniest shit I think about with Dave is we're playing this place called Club Soda in Montreal. And side note, I fucking love Montreal. Anyway, so we're on stage and I'm up at the front and I'm doing backing vocals on whatever fucking song it was. And I'm singing and I notice I can't hear him anymore. You know, he had that fucking, you know, you know, when Dave was talking, when he was singing and when he's not, you know, if it's quiet, you know, you can definitely hear him.
Yeah.
So I know he's not singing. I'm like, oh fuck. I turn around and he's probably 15 feet off of my hip behind me towards the drums. And I look at him. And I can see in his mask, you see his eyes really big, and he's looking right at me. And I was just like, what the fuck's he doing? What are you doing? And he just looks and he smiles, he grins a little bit, and then he just projectile vomits. Fucking almost all the way right to me.
Like,
and I'm like 15
like for real.
Feet away from him.
For real.
Yeah. Just fucking, like fucking, like, like the fucking, you know, just like the movies, like pea soup and the fucking Linda Blair shit.
Right. So did people think that was part of the show?
Yeah. And I look at him and then, you know, this continues for, you know, I mean, 30 seconds is a long time if you're just going, so it's like. It's like a long time, you know, and I'm thinking, it's exorcist shit. And I look at him, and then he stops, and he wipes his mouth off, and the music is still banging, like the song is still going on. And I'm looking at him, and then he looks at me, and he grins really big, and I take a step back, and I go, what the fuck, are you okay? You know, because you can hear on the stage, you can talk to each other. And then he just looks at me again, he stares, and lets another fucking one fly, and I was just like, holy shit, what the fuck, he's gonna fucking die right here. And I walk over to him, I go, are you okay? And he goes, no, I'm not okay. And he's laughing at me the whole time though, you know, and I'm just like, oh my God. And afterwards, he just fucking laid down in a slump of shit down in the backstage. I go, what the fuck? He goes, Kay, you gotta make me not drink so many Red Bulls before the show.
It was your fault.
He'd pound, you know, sometimes he'd throw down fucking 5 or 6 Red Bulls before the show.
Oh, jeez.
Just like slam them, like fucking, I'm just like, whoo.
That's unbelievable. I mean, did you ever think about, I don't know, writing a book about your time in Guar or anything?
There's, you know, that's just a single story that could take up a fucking whole chapter.
Right.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable. Yeah. Man, so, well, I'll tell you what, let's talk about Mobile Death Camp here. We might have to have you on again just to talk about more Guar stories, okay? So maybe next time,
man.
Maybe we should make this a recurring thing here on the podcast. We'll get you like four or five Guar stories that you can, so what are you guys doing with Mobile Death Camp? What's happening with the band?
Man, we just got off tour with Havoc and Ringworm. We did a little West Coast run with those guys. It was awesome, man. We got a new EP just came out October 4th. It's called Volume 4-ish. And, yeah, it's, you know, huge Black Sabbath fans. And this is the band's fourth record. So I was like, well, how about Volume 4-ish? Because, you know, there's only like, it's an EP, so it's really short.
Right.
There's only like five songs on it. And so I'm like, that's not really a record. Ish. Volume 4-ish. And then we did the, you know, changed out Ozzy and put a Squatch on it because the Squatch is my lord and master.
That is hysterical. But,
things are rolling good, man. We're getting a lot of great reviews with that thing and a lot of good fan reaction. And it's, you know, it's kind of going like the thrash, the punk. More of my punk roots are showing on this one. And it seems to make people a little happier. They say, you know, I mean, I'm not that guy that goes, we really don't sound, you know, what's your band sound like? When you ask people, you know, oh, you're in a band? Yeah, what's your band called? Oh, the Go-Getters. Oh, cool. What do you guys sound like? And they go, oh, well, we really don't sound like anybody. You know, I go, listen, if Jeff Beck isn't in your band, you sound like fucking somebody.
Right.
You know, but we're starting to, with the punk edge is showing more in our shit. We're kind of getting away or we're not, you know. I don't think we're lumped into like the Overkill and Testament type, you know, thrash, like by the book thrash. You know, we got a little, I like to think we got a little edge to it, a little different, you know, not quite Municipal Waste-ish, but somewhere between the Waste and Slayer and DRI and Voivod and that kind of, you know, who knows?
So you
taste
just,
it, you know, take a little taste. If you like it, drink it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, named off all my grandmother's favorite bands. So, yeah, she'll love you guys. Well, I'll tell you what, Todd, I could talk to you all day long, but yeah, maybe we'll have to have you back because I want to hear some more of these stories because, you know, when I first met you, my first thought was, what is it like to be in Guar? I mean, there's like bands like, you know, Slayer and stuff like that, but Guar's reputation and the history of the band and things that you guys have gone through and the stuff that goes on stage and everything, just like, is there another band that's like that? I can't think of one off the top of my head.
I wouldn't think so, man. I mean, back in the day, I saw the Impotent Sea Snakes. They were kind of fucking wild. I mean, Kiss is kind of crazy like that. Alice Cooper, you know, this Guar takes it to a punk rock fucking street punk level. You know, that those bands didn't.
Yeah, I think I think like with Guar, though, I don't, you know, maybe because I don't really live in that world per se, but I don't know that much about what happens with the band. I've interviewed Kiss and I've interviewed Alice Cooper and guys like that. And you kind of know how they are off the stage and whatnot, you know, but I never met Dave Brocky. And I, you know, and by the picture you're painting, man, this dude is pretty wild.
He was very wild, but at the same time, you know, he built a fucking dynasty, man.
Yeah,
you know, it's crazy. He's the first one to make the right move. He's the first one to shoot himself in the foot.
Is that right?
You know, he's the first one to make the best contact. He's the first one to burn that fucking bridge. He's
man.
He's all those dudes wrapped into one dude.
Well, that's unbelievable. Well, listen, Todd, I'll tell you what, man. We'll cut you loose here, and hopefully next time I talk to you, you got something better than a flip phone. Your phone sounds great, by the way. It sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah. Flip phone. Hey, I appreciate you, man, bringing me on. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, dude, my pleasure, dude. Great stories, and we'll have to do this again.
That's right, man. I fucking dig it. Have a great day. I've been a fan of Riff forever, and everybody that comes out of there, man. You know, I was trying to get Arthur P. info out of you last time I saw you. mean, and then I just found my fucking, do you remember, maybe your grandma remembers with her favorite bands, Riff used to put out this thing called the Dread Card.
Right, right. Yeah, I've seen a few of those in my time, yeah.
Detroit rockers engaged to get for the abolition of disco.
Right,
I just found mine. I just found it. I was like, holy shit, this is great.
And there he is, Todd Evans from Mobile Death Camp. And, yeah, talking about the classic WRIF, days and stuff in the way in the past. So we do have a podcast out right now called The History of WRIF. And you can check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Mike Staff, a former staffer here at the radio station, actually interviews a couple of legendary DJs. And that all has, you know, if you're listening outside the area, of course, disregard or check it out if you'd like. It is actually pretty cool. Anyways, if you are listening, you made it this far. Hope you guys enjoyed this. 5-star ratings. You can write reviews. Keep coming back. I got Gary Hoey coming up. Of course, it's getting to that time of year, right? And some other guests here before we close down 2019. But as always, I hope you guys really like this. I try to do the best job I can to talk about the artist and not about myself. It pisses me off when I'm listening to some of these podcasts out there, and it's like the people interviewing the people talk about themselves, and it's like, okay, I don't want to hear about you. Okay, I want to hear about the guest and whatnot. So anyways, you get the picture. We try to stay on track and give you guys as much info about your favorite bands and not about the douchebag talking to your favorite band than we can. I do appreciate you guys listening. Like I said, thanks so much. We'll do it all over again real soon.